to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. We're your hosts for today, Greta Anderson
and Susan Franzen. This week, we feature two different cultural opportunities available in Ames.
One is the annual Musicale for Ames Town and Gown Chamber Music Association, an evening of musical entertainment and food. Susan talks with Paula Forrest, the artistic director of this long-standing Ames organization.
It's often said that music lifts you to the heavens. The second cultural opportunity we feature today takes the viewer right up there into the skies. Greta talks with Dr. J.R. Paulson, a.k.a. Sky Doc, a man who spends his days as a family physician and his evenings gazing at the night skies and taking stunning photographs of faraway galaxies.
I was so intrigued by these photographs, I tracked down the Ames Area Amateur Astronomers Club and talked to two of its leaders, Al Johnson and Ed Engel, about their programming.
Well, before going out of this world, let's hear some music from a German vocal ensemble that is coming to Ames in the spring to perform for our featured organization, Town and Gown.
Nun ist es Zeit, ihr lieben Leute, mit viel Humor, spitz Feuer, stellt kein Muss sich persönlich vor.
Die Frau gebührt zuerst Applaus, sie kann am besten hören, was ich bin, das sieht mir jeder an.
Man sieht es an
von diesen Herren, der so
braucht. Da, 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 da.
I am Paula Forrest, and I have the privilege of being the artistic director of the Ames Town and Gown Chamber Music Association.
Could you give us a brief description of Town and Gown?
Certainly. Well, Town and Gown is a series. We are called the Town and Gown Chamber Music Association. We are a concert series that presents small ensembles playing mostly classical music or music that is appropriate for a classical music series. We present five concerts a year of internationally renowned artists from around the world, and we present them in two locations. One is at the Ames City Auditorium, and the other is at the Martha Ellentye Recital Hall on campus of Iowa State University. So we feel that that is an appropriate name, Town and Gown, because we really do not only present both in town and at the university, thus academic gown, but we also pull our audience from the larger community as well as the university community. We have some at each of those locations.
A little history of what Town and Gown means. I think it goes back to the Middle Ages, doesn't it?
I think so. When people who went to university actually wore their academic gowns at all times. And so we want to make sure that people do understand that this has nothing to do with fancy dress in order to come to our concerts, but it does refer to the fact that we are an organization that brings together the university and the town of Ames.
There's a musicale that is coming up on February 16th, is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. The musicale is personally my favorite night of the year. It's a night when we program musicians from all over Ames, including the university, people who generously just perform for us, people ranging from the newly named Amara Piano Quartet, which used to be the Ames Piano Quartet, and other members of faculty at the university, some students from the university, but then we will have other people such as our friend Emil Polaszek, who many people know in town as a singer, but he's also a wonderful accordion player, and he will be doing that night. We'll be having some members of the cast from Tom Foolery. So if you saw that great show presented by actors a few months ago, you can enjoy some of those things again. And if you missed it, this is your chance to see a few minutes of that. We will also have some speakers doing some reading of interesting letters from the Schumanns. We'll have Kevin Schilling and Heather Payton playing oboe from the university. Kevin Amadon is a professor of German here, but he's also a terrific violinist and violist, and he's concertmaster of the Central Iowa Symphony. He and I will be playing something. And then a special nice feature is that we will have a young string quartet named the Clear String Quartet, youngsters who are of middle school and high school age, but who play beautifully together and have been coached by Alan Henson. So this is a way to really bring so much of the musical community together. So many of the musical organizations are represented, as well as individuals. And then we have a wonderful buffet afterwards where everyone can celebrate and meet each other and have a great time.
Well, this sounds like a not to miss.
I think it's a not to miss. People who have been there once usually tend to come back.
If our listeners want to come to the musicale after they hear what it is, they can just call you and make reservations. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes. Our website is www.townandgown, all just spelled out, .org. www.townandgown.org. Or you could email us at town.gown@gmail.com, or you can phone me. And my phone number is 515-292-3891. Any one of those ways, we will be happy to accommodate you with tickets. There will also be some available at the door, but it can get we get a pretty good-sized audience, so it would be best to do it in advance.
For those people who don't know about Town and Gown, I think you have a very distinguished, interesting history. Where did it get started and when and why?
It got started by some members of the community in 1949, somewhat at the instigation of the Rotary Club, decided that Ames really deserved some wonderful musicians to come through town. So Daniel Zaffirano was among the people who started this, and they got something going pretty quickly, and in 1950, they had their first concert, and they were bringing really great musicians of every sort to Ames for the first time in an actual series. This was not limited to chamber music at that time. They had everything from major opera stars to string quartets, pianists, choruses, things like that. And it had a huge success right away, and they were having the concerts at the old high school. And as I understand it, they sold out their subscriptions right away when they started this series. People were starved for such a thing in this town.
Now, the old high school, is this is not the current City Hall.
Yes, it is the current City Hall, which I understand has gone through times of being the high school and the junior high. I'm not sure which it was in 1950. But that is the one.
And it's the same auditorium that you use for the town concerts today.
We have come full circle. The concerts have gone from the City Hall to other locations, including Fisher Theater and the Martha Ellen Tye Recital Hall. And now we have this nice combination of places. When C.Y. Stevens was built, that threw everything into a new situation, because C.Y. Stevens then began to bring big orchestras for big audiences to town. And so Town and Gown sort of, I think, rethought itself a little bit. And it, at that time, became a chamber music series. I like to try to make sure that we have a very balanced program and something for everyone, for different people's musical tastes within the confines of this kind of music. We always have a string quartet. A string quartet is the core of what people consider chamber music. So we always make sure to have at least a string quartet represented on the program. We always have a piano recital, either a solo pianist or a duo team. That also is something that's extremely popular in this town. And then beyond that, we may have a trio of a clarinet, viola, and piano. We go sometimes a little farther afield. We might have a saxophone quartet or a recorder quartet. This year, we're having later in the season, a Baroque ensemble performing on instruments of the 18th century. In five concerts, we just try to, as I say, make it something balanced. Often we have a vocal component as well, something. So this year we're having an ensemble. We get hundreds of solicitations. There's no shortage of available talent out there.
You have three concerts still coming up this year. Could you tell a little bit about them?
Yes, certainly. Our first quartet is a Canadian ensemble called the Cecilia String Quartet. They're an award-winning young string quartet of women. They will be playing a program that includes a quintet by Mozart that includes an extra viola. And for that, we will have Jonathan Sturm of the Iowa State University faculty, as well as the Amara Quartet, and he's also the concertmaster of the Des Moines Symphony. Jonathan Sturm will be joining them in that concert to play the Mozart Quintet, but in addition to that, they will be playing works by Mozart and Ravel, and we're looking forward to them. They have an outstanding reputation.
That's in March,
That's
right?
That's in March. In April, we have a wonderful vocal ensemble that I'm very excited to be bringing. It's a five-member ensemble, four men and one woman, one of the men being a countertenor. So it'll be a really gorgeous blend of sound. And they come from Leipzig. They're called the Kalmus Ensemble Leipzig. They are an a cappella ensemble. And they will be doing works from the 17th century to the present. They are sort of protégés of the King's Singers. And like them, they will be doing a program that does include some lighter music as well. In the middle of May, we'll be presenting a trio that plays 18th century music on 18th century instruments. The violins and cellos have developed differently since that time, and there was no piano at the time, so they will be playing on harpsichord. And the violinist of this group is someone who has developed a very big reputation as a virtuoso solo violinist. Her name is Rachel Barton Pine. She plays all over the world as a soloist, but she also is very, very interested in all kinds of music, from Baroque music to punk, and is outstanding in everything she does. And so she and some fellow musicians from Chicago have formed this trio that does the music of the 17th century, 17th and 18th century.
In addition to the full range of concerts and this musicale, are there any other things that Town and Gown does?
Yes, we really like as much as possible to bring our artists beyond the stage and into the community in other ways. And so we have some sort of an outreach aspect for several of our concerts each season. We will sometimes have events before the concert or after the concert at the public library where anybody can come and meet the artists and sort of see a little bit more of what they do and get a little bit more explanation of what they do. We have taken artists into the public schools. This year, the Trio Settecento will be talking about early musical instruments with the orchestra students at Ames High School. Often, the artists offer master classes, which means that this great musician will listen to younger musicians and offer them a lesson, but that lesson is open to the public, and that can be a fascinating event.
So where do you get your support?
Town and Gown exists through the generosity of this community. We do very much appreciate all the support that we get. Of course, the largest amount of support is from our ticket holders and our donors, who have always been very generous over the years. But we also owe a great deal to the generosity of the City of Ames through the Commission on the Arts, which substantially supports Ames Town and Gown. And the Koala Family Foundation has also been very generous to Town and Gown. Kevin Schilling has been part of the musicale, I think, maybe he's missed one year in 24 or something. I mean, people have been so generous taking part. The Ames Piano Quartet has been involved in it from the very beginning.
Well, I hope that our audiences appreciate that.
I think our audiences do seem to appreciate it, and I'm happy to say that they are thriving and growing. Please join us.
Well, once again, the instigation for this program was the upcoming musicale, which you described in beautiful detail earlier.
Thank
but
you.
For those who might have missed it because they tuned in late, could you just give a quick recap?
Yes. The musicale is on February 16th in the beautiful sanctuary of the St. John's Episcopal Church, and the buffet afterwards takes place in their parish hall. It will be at 7 o'clock in the evening so that everybody has time to enjoy a generous concert of all these wonderful people from around town and then enjoy the buffet.
So for anybody who missed the musicians and the full evening description, can they find that on your website?
Yes, absolutely. We have a website that will tell all the details, as well as I said, tickets will be available that way.
Thank you very much, Paula. This has been a most enjoyable interview, and I hope that our listeners enjoy it as much as I did.
This This is Local Talk, and I'm Greta Anderson, your co-host today with Susan Franzen. We're talking about upcoming cultural events in the Ames area. Susan, what did we just hear?
Both of those selections were by Kalmus Ensemble Leipzig, a German vocal quintet that is coming to Ames in the spring to perform for Town and Gown.
That Town and Gown musicale that Paula talked about, coming up February 16th at St. John's, sounds like quite the event. Susan, have you ever been to the musicale?
Oh, I've gone many times, and it's one of my favorite events in Ames. But speaking of events not to miss, I have to plug the exhibit for the Grinnell photographer and physician who calls himself Sky Doc. The exhibit is just astonishing, and the detailed descriptions that accompany the photographs are awe-inspiring. I was looking at one particularly lovely photograph and did what I normally do. I looked over at the caption, and I found out that I was looking at a galaxy that was 300 million light years away. That means that what I was looking at happened 300 million years ago. It just blew me away.
I like the pictures of the galaxies that are colliding, or rather colliding hundreds of millions of years ago, and his pictures of the roiling, boiling sun.
I'm curious to hear what the Sky Doc has to say. Let's listen.
This is Greta Anderson from KHOI. I'm here at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Ames talking with J.R. Paulson, otherwise known as Sky Doc, because J.R. by day is a physician and by night studies the skies and takes amazing photographs. And those photographs are now up at the UUFA's Gallery in the Round. Welcome, JR, to KHOI. When did you first start looking at the sky?
In fourth and fifth grade, I received a Tasco telescope, one of the cheap ones back then, and immediately went out on Christmas in the cold night air and looked at the moon and the Andromeda Galaxy and Saturn. And once I saw those through even a little telescope, I was hooked. And then in junior high, it led me into reading as much as I could about the origin of the universe and where are we in the universe and how does all of this fit together.
When did you develop this interest of yours into photography?
We were on a bed and breakfast in Grinnell called Marsh House, and when we got done restoring that house, I'm one who always has to look for a new project. So I thought I would get back into astronomy. This was about 15 years ago. Because I hadn't, through my training and night hours, had not really had much time at night being on call. And Iowa has beautiful skies. We have some of the best skies in the United States. And we're blessed to have that here without a lot of pollution. And in Grinnell area, we don't have much light pollution. So I bought a large telescope, the largest one I could find, but found out that it was extremely heavier than I would have guessed by looking at the picture of it. Well, I hauled it in and out every night in my backyard to take pictures, but it was about 180 pounds. And pretty soon, being a physician, I diagnosed a ruptured disc in my back.
Oh, no.
Well, my wife, Linda, said, well, just sell that big telescope and just get a little one that you could haul around. But when I was recuperating in the hospital from my surgery, I had my older son, Sean, ask him if he would help me build an observatory for my big telescope on my partner's farm 5 miles east of town. And he said, sure. So I designed a dome and a two-story observatory where the telescope is permanently mounted on a big pier that sinks in the ground. Also, since I wanted to get back into astrophotography, which I'd done as a child, I realized that everything was moving to digital. And digitally, rather than in the old days, I just had to, you'd mount your camera right up by the eyepiece and take a picture of it. Now they have special digital cameras that would capture just tiny amounts of light, not regular cameras. But the problem was these were all computer controlled. And I also realized that my telescope had to be computer-controlled, too, robotic, to follow the stars and the objects through the sky. So while I was in the hospital recuperating, I bought a computer for dummies and started climbing the curve of using computers. But it wasn't very long until I realized that by using a computerized camera or a digital camera that you can capture almost every photon of light. Where if you use film and you expose for 3 or 4 hours, which I often do, the film would be totally overexposed, it would be sky noise, and you just can't do that. Even big telescopes of Mount Palomar cannot take long exposure pictures. But digitally, what you can do is take a whole bunch of short exposures, say 5 minutes apiece, and then you can stack those electronically. And it's like taking more and more pictures, getting more and more light, which in another way is looking further back in time. And then you can take them through different filters, through red, green, and blue filters. So I may take an hour with a red filter, an hour green, an hour blue, maybe 2 hours without any filter. And then you combine these into master colors of each one. And then you combine the color with the black and white. And then you have a tremendous amount of data to work with. But that's just the start. I realize that all of that data is there, but to get the incredible detail, it has to be processed because there's still lots of, quote, noise, electronic noise or light pollution noise, even in Iowa. So then there are many techniques that can be used to process the images that bring out the faint details that is really there that you don't originally see. And that is also very exciting when you've spent this time and looking at an object that you might not even see with a naked eye. And sometimes you don't even see it through the telescope with your eye. And then on faith, you photograph the area of the sky. And then when you develop it electronically and then you see it's there, it's very humbling and satisfying.
So you aim your telescope at that part of the sky because somebody has calculated that a special object will be in that part of the sky?
Correct. Yep.
Okay.
The galaxies and the stars, they don't change much from season to season. And, of course, the planets and the moon and the sun change every day. So those you have to calculate new positions for. But also you can see those with your naked eye. So it's pretty easy to find the moon and Jupiter.
You don't have just one telescope, though, do you?
Correct. I have two telescopes at my observatory. One is a large 14-inch Celestron reflecting telescope, which has a large mirror. And then piggyback on top of that, I mounted a 4-inch in diameter refracting telescope. And then I did follow my wife's advice and bought an 8-inch portable telescope that I can take to star parties and whatever. So I have those telescopes. In addition, over the years, I've also purchased a telescope that is dedicated only to looking at the sun, solar telescope, which you can't use to look at anything else because it has so much filtration in it that the moon would even be dark.
You have a lot of images of the sun up here at the exhibit. Let's talk about the sun. The pictures that are really remarkable over there are a picture of Venus coming right in front of the sun and a picture of the solar flare. What should everybody know about the sun?
Well, what's fun about astronomy, when I started becoming interested in the sun, it's no longer a night hobby, which is also nice on your sleep because you can image the sun in the day. Most of the time, if you just look at the sun with a regular telescope or binoculars with a special filter, you just see maybe sunspots is the only detail that you can see. But with special filters called H-alpha filters, they allow you to see the part of the sun, the upper layer that's called the chromosphere. And the chromosphere is what has all of the flares and prominences. And you can see the surface that actually looks like a boiling cauldron. So when you look at the sun through this telescope, you're seeing flares come up, you're seeing movement in the sun, it's just live action of the sun. And you never know what you're going to find or see because we don't know what's going to be happening on the sun. So that's very exciting, fun daytime observing to that. And then once in a while, if you're lucky, you have your camera set at the same time so that you can catch these unusual flares or prominences from the sun. So I think it's just very exciting. And another thing for viewers to note or listeners is that the sun goes through cycles, these sunspot cycles, which most people have heard. And that's about every 11 years on average. This year was a little more spread out. And so every 11 years, the sun will have a large number of sunspots. And then they'll fade down and have a minimum number. And then 11 years, they'll peak again. And we're just headed toward a peak. And when there are a peak of sunspots, there's a peak of flares and an increase of solar activity. So this is a really exciting time. I remember 5 years ago looking at the sun, and it was pretty boring. Some days you could go and look at the sun and see no sunspots or very little flares or activities.
Are sun flares something that we have to worry about?
Yes. It's predicted that we have a good chance in the next 2 or 3 years to have a pretty major solar flare come toward the Earth. And we are protected by our large magnetic field around the Earth called the magnetosphere, and that deflects much of the radiation in the solar flares. However, if we get a direct hit from a solar flare, it has the potential to completely destroy satellites, all of our cell phones, landlines, transformers, and it would put us back into the pre-electricity era for many months and possibly even years.
Have we ever been hit by one before?
Yes. We were hit by a large solar flare that was a pretty much direct hit in 1859. And the way we know this is because all of the telegraph lines got toasted. Because what happens when the solar flare comes, it sets up charges in any wires that there are. And so all of these, then, of course, it was just telephone. They were not telephone lines, but telegraph lines. They just became supercharged with electricity and burned out a lot of the telegraph relay stations. We also know that when you have solar flares, that's the time when you have the aurora borealis, which we see, or the northern lights, which hopefully most of you have seen at some time. And if not, it's just a spectacular display. And those northern lights are usually just seen in Alaska or Canada, or once in a while in Iowa, or the northern states, when there's a lot of solar activity. But during the 59 event, the aurora borealis was seen down as far south as Florida in the Caribbean. So you can just imagine the power of the radiation that was coming into the Earth at that time.
Of a man peering through a telescope evokes this searching, questing spirit. What sorts of things have you learned looking at the skies?
Well, one of the reasons that I love astronomy so much is it puts you in your place in the sense that when you're looking at an object, since it's the Andromeda Galaxy, which is a twin galaxy to ours, and you realize that that light left there 2.5 million years ago, and now you are just seeing it, it gives you a different appreciation of time. And when I see some of my other galaxies that may be hundreds of millions of light years away, this is the time before the dinosaurs has left these places. So it makes you appreciate time on a very different scale than we're used to on Earth, looking at our clocks or watches, or even geologic time. I'm humbled when I think of our Milky Way galaxy rotating once every quarter of a billion years. So as I peer out there and see our own Milky Way, just knowing that this whole Milky Way is rotating and we're being carried along with it at hundreds of thousands of miles an hour, and that we will turn around once in 250 million years, and then that our galaxy has been rotating for a long time, that's also, I think, humbling on the time point of view.
You must feel a kinship with those philosophers who have looked out in the skies and for clues of, to the great questions in life, you know, why are we here?
Exactly. And I was a philosophy major in college, so this comes easy and naturally to me. But I think every one of us, from the first caveman to the nomads in Arabia that slept under the stars and named many of the stars, by the way, from the Arabic cultures, I think any man or woman who's been outside at night or is particularly with the Milky Way and taken time to look up, I think we all have a human kinship of what's up there, where are we, what's our place, what's it all mean, and what's going to happen to us. And I think some people worry about what's going to happen tomorrow, but it's also, I think, astronomy with the theories of what will happen to our sun and what eventually will happen to our galaxy and what will happen. And we've got a lot of the answers. We didn't many decades ago, but we certainly don't have all the answers now, but we've got a pretty good idea of again, our place in the universe and how the processes occur.
A nebula?
A nebula comes from a Latin word, I think, that means cloud. And when they originally looked at these areas in the sky with telescopes, they saw what looked like clouds. And they often called those nebula, which because they look like little white clouds. Well, as we got better and better telescopes, we realized that a lot of those clouds were actually galaxies, which were thousands and hundreds and millions of stars, much like our own. And so those nebula, with better observation, we designated those as galaxies. But a lot of the other ones did not resolve into stars, and we realized that there were huge gas clouds, and most of those gas clouds are within our own Milky Way at a relatively close distance. And what we're seeing is these glowing clouds that are illuminated either directly from starlight shining on them directly and cause them to glow in sometimes beautiful colors, and also sometimes they glow with reflected light, as you could see in looking in a lake, for example. You can see the blue water. Well, that's reflection from the blue light that's come through the atmosphere. And so the nebula are also, because they're closer, they're more available to amateur astronomers to be able to see.
Tell the audience about that picture in the other room where you used filters that are used at the Hubble telescope.
Correct.
To distinguish the elements.
One of the pictures I have in the display is called the Eagle Nebula. And most people, if you just showed a picture of that, they would say, oh yeah, I've seen that, because it's made famous by Hubble. It's iconic for the Hubble Space Telescope. And what's neat about it is the Hubble telescope is not just to take pretty pictures. I mean, that's nice, but it's up there to try to get knowledge about the universe. And if you use the telescope, either mine or the Hubble, that only allows certain wavelengths of light, you can also do an analysis of the heavens or of an object. When you put certain filters in front of the telescope and look at the Eagle Nebula, the one, for example, that I used here, it shows the color, and the yellow color that you see in this is representative of sulfur. in the wavelength that sulfur will give off when it's heated. Some of the other ones on the Hubble and on my picture that are green and bluish are oxygen. So you're looking at oxygen. You know what's out there. Where before we just thought these were gases and colors, but by using these filters, you can do a spectroscopic analysis of what they're made out of. And then hydrogen and helium usually show up as a red with these Hubble filters. So what would normally look like just as a white nebula or maybe a red nebula with filters like this, you can actually see what it's made out of. And I think what's fascinating is we find, of course, the same elements that we find on Earth. And so here's oxygen and sulfur and hydrogen and helium and the other elements, and we find, wow, these are the kind of the same elements that we have here. And I think that's also fascinating, that the laws of physics and the things we find here are also the things that are going on in other stars and other nebulas.
You also have a bunch of pictures of the moon. What do you like about photographing the moon?
What I like about the moon is the intimate familiarity we all have with it, because we can go up and we can see or imagine the man in the moon. I don't see it very well, but whatever you want to imagine. But even with binoculars or a very small telescope, you can see craters and mountain ranges. And I think with a little bit larger telescope, but it doesn't have to be a really expensive one or a big one that a university would have, but even a modest-sized telescope looking at the moon, I think anybody that's ever done that, it's an emotional experience. It isn't just an intellectual, oh, that's a pretty picture. You get a feeling that you're like almost flying over the moon, like you are there. It has a visceral, I think, effect looking through a telescope. And those effects I like to try to capture in photography also. But even though the photographs are neat, one of my pictures shows one that's probably as close as pictures that were taken by the surveyor that actually flew around the moon and took pictures of it. And I can see almost as well as you can if you went up and flew around the moon with a telescope, which is kind of neat.
You were describing some mountain ranges, and you pointed at a picture and said, that's where Apollo landed.
Correct. You can go on Google and look and see where all the landing sites were from the Apollo missions. And one of the pictures I have here called Bradley Rill is an area where they specifically wanted to land because it was close enough to a mountain range and some of these trenches on the moon that they thought would be good exploring. And it's fun to be able to show someone and say, hey, that's exactly where they landed.
Did they actually walk up the ridges?
No.
They only took one step for mankind,
yeah.
Right?
On that mission, they did lots of sampling of the different rocks. But they still have to be careful on the moon. And even what look like small mountains and the gravity, you don't want to have your spacesuit fall and rip or you think you'd be in big trouble.
And then there's these interesting photographs of galaxies colliding.
Yeah, as I got further and I would say deeper into astronomy, I became more fascinated with galaxies and then galaxies interacting. And I tried to find galaxies that would be colliding, like watching two cars collide. But these are galaxies with hundreds of billions of stars running into one another. What do they do and why do they do that? And I found out by studying that an amateur can actually get some decent photographs of some of these colliding galaxies. What's interesting is that even though the galaxies collide, you would think that all these stars would collide also. But that, in fact, is not the case. That very rarely, even though these hundreds of billions of stars are running into each other, there's so much space within the galaxy that the chances of an actual stars colliding are very, very slim. But what does happen is the gases that are within the galaxies, they collide and they cause tremendous forces and riptides and with them, and that can cause the birth of new stars. And so it's almost a birthing process when these galaxies collide, their dust paths run into in each other, and then all of a sudden there are areas that new stars are born. So you're kind of seeing a nursery in some of these galaxies and collisions. When it goes supernova, what happens is the star literally does explode, and that's one of the things that stars can do when they die, but not all. If they have a certain mass, then they can go what's called supernova, where they start shrinking and implode on themselves and then rebound out with this tremendous explosion. And what happens to all the gas in the dust, it's an incubator for new element formation. And that's where all the heavy elements are formed very often, the ones that are high in the periodic chart. And all the iron in your body was formed in the middle of a star. And
we were just listening to Al Johnson and Ed Engel of the Ames area amateur astronomers.
Stars,
Susan, do you ever get the feeling that there are just dozens of interesting things going on in this community?
Yes,
and one way that our listeners can connect with all of them is to tune into our community calendar at 10:55 a.m. and 10:55 p.m. Monday through Friday.
And thanks to our intern Cristobal Matabag, those opportunities are regularly updated on our website, khoifm.org. If your group has an event to announce, you can email Chris at khoinews@gmail.com. That's khoinews at gmail.com. Put calendar in the subject line.
Astral bodies and so forth. How does that relate to your everyday practice as a physician?
That is a very good question. I've never been asked that. I'm just an inquisitive type person, and in medicine, the human body, and particularly the human mind, is extremely fascinating. And every person is unique, and every body is unique. We all have similarities, but there's uniqueness and there's depth. And the longer you're in practice, the more you don't know. And you find out the complexity of both humans and disease and mind. And the more I get into astronomy, the more I realize the bigger the universe is, and the more things about it that we don't understand. And so I think those two things are similar.
What type of medicine do you practice?
I do family practice, mainly. I'm a family physician, but I also have certification in sports medicine and sexual therapy, and I've been hospice and palliative care for 30 years, and I'm the hospice medical director, so I really like hospice, which also has a philosophic bent because of the nature of end of life and philosophical issues, mainly spiritual issues that people have at the end of their life. And that spirituality in medicine, I guess, also wraps around or comes back to our place in the universe, and where are we and why are we here and what happens to us after we die, and all of these eternal questions, I think, that we're all searching for at different times. Astronomy, when I'm out at my observatory and having some Bach music on, is just helps give me a little peace also when you've just seen some people that are near the end of life or have passed. One of my patients who just died this last year made me a beautiful quilt or blanket that's a big blue background with all of these stars on it. So I have that at my observatory to keep me warm if it's cold. That's a nice reminder.
What is your advice for somebody who wants to get involved looking at the skies? How do you go about learning about it, and how do you keep it interesting?
My suggestion is that the best thing to do is to visit one of your local astronomy clubs. It's just like anything else that you do. If there are people above and below you on the learning curve, and they can show you and help you pick telescopes, and you can go out with them and they can point and show you where things are, and they have resources that they can direct you to, and just the camaraderie and the fun. So I think anybody that's interested, it's absolutely the best. You can do it on your own, buy a telescope and go through books and charts and et cetera. But I think the fun and moving up the curve and being helped can't be replaced. And there are amateur clubs almost all over the United States, no matter where you find them.
JR, it's been a pleasure to talk with you.
It's been my pleasure to be here, and I enjoyed talking with you too, Greta.
Whenever life gets you down, Mrs. Brown, and things seem hard or tough, and people are stupid, obnoxious, or daft, and you feel that you've had quite enough, just remember that you're standing on a planet that's evolving, and revolving at 900 miles an hour. that's orbiting at 90 miles a second, so it's reckoned, a sun that is the source of all our power. The sun and you and me and all the stars that we can see are moving at a million miles a day. In an outer spiral arm at 40,000 miles an hour of the galaxy we call the Milky Way. Our galaxy itself contains 100 billion stars. It's 100,000 light years side to side. It bulges in the middle, 16,000 light years thick, but out by us it's just 3,000 light years wide. We're 30,000 light years from galactic central point. We go round every 200 million years. And our galaxy is only one of millions of billions in this amazing and expanding universe. Keeps on expanding and expanding in all of the directions it can whiz. As fast as it can go, at the speed of light, you know, 12 million miles a minute, and that's the fastest speed there is. So remember when you're feeling very small and insecure, how amazingly unlikely is your birth. And pray that there's intelligent life somewhere up in space, 'cause there's bugger all down here on Earth.
You're listening to Local Talk. I'm your co-host, Susan Franzen, together with Greta Anderson. We just heard from Grinnell amateur astronomer and astrophotographer Dr. J.R. Paulson, or SkyDoc, whose work is up in the gallery in the round at 1015 North Highland in Ames.
This is the last week it will be up. The hours are Monday through Friday, 1 to 5.
The SkyDoc mentioned amateur astronomy clubs. Does Ames have one of those?
Oh, you know it, Susan. And I got to talk with a couple of its leaders the other day.
This is Greta Anderson of Local Talk. I am here with two members of the Ames Area Amateur Astronomers. Al Johnson, who is the president. Hi, Al.
Hi.
And Ed Engel, a past president and soon-to-be newsletter editor.
Yes, hi.
What does the Ames Area Amateur Astronomer Group do?
We have 11 meetings a year where we have speakers.
And then we also provide, over the course of the year, star parties.
Star parties.
Mm-hmm. And these are events where groups will contact us and ask if we can provide members to bring and operate telescopes for those groups to look at the sky. Boy Scouts, Cub Scouts, Girl Scouts, and 4-H groups.
We have star parties as well after each of our meetings. All the people that come to our meetings are invited to go to our observatory and look at the number of different telescopes we have, and we have them set up on whatever we can find that's interesting that evening.
You have your own observatory.
We do.
It's located at Story County Conservation Center. It's actually just east of Story County Conservation Center.
At McFarland Park.
We have quite a bit of equipment out there, and as a member, you can be checked out and you can get your own telescope and take it and use it. There is a membership fee. People interested in joining can go to our website, which is amesastronomers.com. Every year we have what we call the Iowa Star Party. It's located at Coon Rapids, and we invite anybody from all over the nation to come and join us. Coon Rapids has some of the darkest skies, certainly the darkest skies in Iowa, but some of the darkest skies in the country.
We aim for the Labor Day weekend. Mm-hmm. The only time we would change that is if it's full moon during the Labor Day weekend like it was this last year.
How often do you look at the skies?
I'd say any time that it's clear and I happen to be outside, I observe at least a little bit. I like to see where the planets are. And one of our members, his main, his sole interest is meteors. And he observes meteors probably five nights out of every week at least. And that's while doing a full-time job during the day. He has insomnia, so.
Isn't there supposed to be a very exciting meteor coming up?
there's a potential for a large meteor shower, I think, about a year from now, maybe a little bit more.
Yeah. A meteor is a little particle, usually a little particle, sometimes big, but generally the size of a grain of sand that is moving with respect to us at several thousand miles an hour. And it impacts the atmosphere of the Earth and heats up and burns up. And then you see it as a flash of light go across the sky. The frequency of meteors is inversely proportional to their size. So the ones that are the size of a grain of sand, if you go out on any dark night, whether there's a meteor shower or not, you'll see about one of those meteors every 15 to 20 minutes on any night that you go out. And during a meteor shower, you'll see quite a few more than that. And then we have meteors that are up to, say, the size of a Volkswagen that might hit every 5 or 6 months. And most all of those happen over the ocean because the ocean covers 2/3 of the world. And those will be a very big fireball, and you might be able to hear them explode, and you know there'd be a shockwave. But they're few and far between. The Tunguska impact, which happened in Siberia in 1908, they think was probably about 30 to 50 feet across, and it came in over Siberia and exploded several thousand feet up in the air. And that explosion was heard all the way to Britain. And it knocked down trees for a 60-mile radius, I think. But those types probably only happen about once every 1,000 years or so. And then the one that killed the dinosaurs was 65 million years ago. And that one was probably 10 kilometers across. And then we had one in Iowa 75 million years ago that was over the town of Manson, where the town of Manson is now, right by Pocahontas County, north and west of here, about 80 miles. And that one was not as big as the one that killed the dinosaurs, but it was big enough that it would have sent a fireball pretty much across the entire state.
We were just listening to Al Johnson and Ed Engel of the Ames Area Amateur Astronomers. Susan, do you ever get the feeling that there are just dozens of interesting things going on in this community?
Yes, and one way that our listeners can connect with all of them is to tune into our community calendar at 10:55 a.m. and 10:55 p.m. Monday through Friday.
And thanks to our intern, Cristobal Matabag, those opportunities are regularly updated on our website, khoifm.org. If your group has an event to announce, you can email Chris at khoinews@gmail.com. That's khoinews@gmail.com. Put calendar in the subject line.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Today, we've been talking about cultural opportunities in Ames. First, we discussed Ames Town and Gown Chamber Music Association, which has an upcoming musicale on February 16th. I spoke with Paula Forrest, the artistic director of the organization. For more information, go to their website, amestownandgown.com. That's one word, amestownandgown.com.
Then, I spoke with Dr. J.R. Paulson, a.k.a. Sky Doc, an astrophotographer from Grinnell. His photographs are up in the gallery in the round at Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, 1015 North Highland Avenue. Hours are 1 to 5, Monday through Friday, or by appointment. Call 292-5960 for an appointment. That's 292-5960.
Finally, we spoke with Al Johnson and Ed Engel of the Ames Area Amateur Astronomers. They have monthly meetings and put on sky parties for interested groups. Their website is amesastronomers.com. Reporters who contributed to this show have been Susan Franzen and Greta Anderson. We have production assistance from Ursula Rudenberg. Local Talk is engineered by Richard Morrison.
Music you heard included Rondo and Kiss from the Rose by Kalmus Ensemble Leipzig, Heaven and Hell Third Movement by Vangelis, The Path Deeper into the Heart by Soltech, and Galaxy Song by Monty Python. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards, from their CD, Ballad of Kate Shelley.
You can also listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org, and see listings of our past guests and resource contact information. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. Your participation as audience makes KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.